Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the February 8th meeting of the Forest Practices Board to order. This is our regular quarterly meeting. Welcome, everyone, to Olympia on this beautiful day. I think to get started, I'd like to start on my far right over here and have board members introduce themselves, please. I think the board has probably noticed. I think the board has probably noticed that there's no mics here today, so just speak up a little, please.
Good morning. I'm Dave Herrera, general public member.
Good morning. My name's Bill Little. I'm a member that represents Timber Union.
Doug Stinson, general public member, small landowner.
Carol Dodge, general public.
Stephen Burnett, ecology's designation today, designee today.
Paula Swedeen, general public member.
And Peter Goldmark, commissioner of public lands.
David Whipple, Department of Fish and Wildlife designee for probably just the morning on a Jackson. We'll probably be here this afternoon.
Norm Schaaf, general public member.
Good morning, Sherry Fox, representing the independent contract logger.
Dave Summers, Washington Counties.
All right, thank you, board members. And the next item will be a safety briefing from Patricia.
Good morning. Welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double door in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. And in the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building and then moving away from the building out the double doors, take the first left and moving away from the building out to the grassy area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. So it's time now to please turn off your pagers and your phones.
Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you.
It is February, as I think we all know, and the legislature's in town. And for that and other reasons, we're going to have a little bit of a sort of a moving chairs around here on the board today. I think several members have made mention of that already, but I just want to make sure that board members understand Tom Davis from Agriculture is not joining us today. Obviously, Tom Laurie is not, and Stephen is here representing DOE on his behalf. Mark Calhoun will join the meeting in the afternoon, and he is from Commerce. Dave Whipple, as was said earlier, will be here for the portion when Anna Jackson, the regular member, is not present. And Dave Summers will have to step out briefly sometime between the hours of 10 and 11 o'clock this morning. So please bear with us as members come and go a little bit today. The next item on this morning's agenda is approval of the minutes from the November regular meeting. These minutes have been published and sent to board members. Do you have any additions or corrections that you wish to make at this time?
I saw one correction on the August 8th meeting. I believe August 8th is Monday.
Well, I believe those minutes have probably already been approved at the November meeting. So any change is probably moot at this point. There is one correction that I would like to make that was caught by our sharp-eyed attorney that often helps the board, and that's on page 9, line 29. The RCW there should be stricken, and in its place, RCW 7609-040 subpart 2 is the correct citation.
Could you repeat that number, please?
Yes. RCW 7609 .040 sub 2 is the correct citation. Are there any other additions or corrections from board members, please? Hearing none, is there a motion for adoption, please?
I move the minutes be adopted as amended.
Second. Thank you. We have a motion properly seconded. Who was the second for that? Okay, that was Doug. Thank you. I have a motion properly supported to adopt the minutes as amended. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. That makes it unanimous. Thank you very much, board members. And with that, we'll move on to the next item on this morning's agenda, which is a report from me to you. I think it's obvious, I've mentioned it already, it's a very busy time for many of us. DNR is busy, as many state agencies are, interacting with the legislature around many different issues. My comment about this session, back in November, I mentioned the huge deficit that was facing the state. That biennial deficit, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of $4.5 to $5 billion, still exists. The legislature has been dealing with the budget deficit for the current fiscal year in a supplemental budget and is moving closer to that. There's a proposal that's passed the House, a proposal that's passed the Senate now, that is presumably in conference and hopefully will be adopted soon to resolve another portion of the projected deficit for the current fiscal year. So the climate in the legislature is dealing with, obviously, the state's budget and considering some policy bills. I think it's clear from what happened in the Senate, there's some effort toward bipartisanship about resolving some of these issues. And there's the whole issue of fees that has come up, not only for DNR, but for many other state agencies. So there are major considerations before the legislature. I think it's important for this board to understand that DNR has worked with stakeholders, including board member Fox, on a FREP bill that has been introduced to the legislature, and I believe will be heard. It's already been heard?
Yes,
okay. Okay, it's already been heard, and we're hopeful that it can be approved by the legislature and help resolve some of these long-standing issues, including funding for the FREP program. In addition, I think it's very important for this board to be aware of the fact that in the governor's biennial budget is a proposal to reduce the Forest Practices Division's budget by 20%. And the expectation that will be made whole or all in part through fees. Now, I'm in discussions with the Office of the Governor about just how this, what proposal will be brought forward to accomplish this whole that is proposed to be enacted in the second year of the biennium. And I will remind the board that in the current biennium, the Forest Practices Division budget was reduced by $4 million, roughly the same amount, resulting in the reduction of 25.7 FTEs to the Forest Practices Division. So as you can see, there has been considerable reductions made. That's about a 20% reduction, as I said. Anticipated or proposed another 20% reduction with the possibility of fees being enacted to replace all or hopefully all of that so that we can continue to focus on enforcing the rules and making sure the compliance of all the rules that have been passed by this board are fully enforced and followed in the forest environment. So that's a major issue for the Department of Natural Resources, and I would hope this board would be concerned about the budget for the Forest Practices Division along with myself. So that concludes my report to the board. The next item on this morning's agenda is an opportunity for public comment. This opportunity for public comment is provided for comments on general board topics. Comments on any board action item that will occur later in the agenda will be allowed prior to that proposed action at the time. So these are for general comments. And I'll remind all members of the public that please limit your comments to... Patricia, what's the standard here? Is it 2 or 3 minutes that I've asked?
Three.
Okay, so please limit your remarks to 3 minutes. And yes, we do keep track. So the first one up for this morning's comment is Sean Contra. Good morning, Sean.
When does the timer start?
It started a few minutes ago.
I'll take Peter and Cara's time too then.
I'll do that.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sean Cantra. I'm the executive director with Seattle Audubon. I think I've had a chance to present before all of you on multiple occasions. But just as a reminder, I was a member of the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group, and I am a current member of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team, both bodies which were created by this board. And I do want to just take a couple of moments this morning to talk about the Forest Practice Board's role on spotted owl issues as they go forward. First, you're scheduled to hear later this morning from Bridget Moran on the status of the implementation team. I just wanted to share a couple of observations about that process. First, I'm very encouraged by recent activities. The group has got, a newfound focus and energy. And have a draft work plan that I believe Bridget will be sharing with you this morning. And this is exciting, and I think it is a valuable way to help move forward on the incentives piece related to spotted owls and the opportunities that our state has in that regard. I think the key word here, though, is in the name of our work group or our team is implementation. And right now what we've got is a plan, and really we need to make sure that we go forward with implementation. So I'd urge you to hold our feet to the fire to make sure that we actually move things forward. You got recommendations a year ago from the working group, and that this implementation team is supposed to be making sure things get implemented. And I think after a fair amount of delay and just slow getting going, we're now on track, but you need to make sure we stay on track. So asking for continued updates. The second thing I wanted to touch base on is just to bring to your attention, if you aren't already aware, the federal government does have a revised draft recovery plan that is supposed to be finalized within the next few days. And there is a key piece in that document that relates to you all. And if you aren't aware of it, I just want to highlight a couple of things. There's two recovery actions in particular that the plan has that directly relate to your responsibilities. Excuse me, so I'm just going to quote a couple of sites here from this so that you're aware of this. On page 61, under the inadequacy of existing regulatory mechanisms, the revised draft recovery plan states that in light of the continued decline of the species, the apparent increase in severity of the threat from barred owls, and information indicating a recent loss of genetic diversity for the species, this revised plan identifies a potentially more important role for state, private, and tribal lands. The service recommends retaining all occupied sites and unoccupied high-quality spotted owl habitat on non-federal lands wherever feasible. The service suggests that states evaluate existing regulations affecting spotted owls and make changes where necessary and appropriate to meet recovery goals. So again, the federal government is urging you guys to look at your regulatory structure as it relates to owls, given the continuing decline, and the need to look at new approaches as necessary. And while they highlight incentives, they also highlight the fact that you need to look at regulatory actions. The specific recovery action, this is a new one compared to the old draft, says, quote, in light of the declining spotted owl population in Washington, the Washington State Forest Practice Board should evaluate the recovery contribution from spotted owl sites on all private lands and design specific protections for those site centers, including sites where protocol surveys have not indicated occupancy by spotted owls for more than 3 years. And again, they don't differentiate between inside associates or outside associates. They're saying all habitat should be, you should look at how you protect all habitat, occupied or not. The other recovery action is recovery action 32, which was in the earlier draft, but they've revised it. And again, I'll just highlight two sentences in there. The recovery action specifically states, quote, to the maximum extent practicable, maintain all of the older and more structurally complex multi-layered coniferous forests on federal and non-federal lands across the range of the spotted owl. And then the next sentence isn't part of the actual text of the recovery action.
Did you get Pete's agreement on this extension?
on the time? I've got one more sentence, just thank you. Maintain, this is the rest of what the Forest Service, or excuse me, the Fish and Wildlife Service says, is maintaining forests with high quality habitat will provide additional support for reducing key threats faced by spotted owls. Protecting these forests should provide spotted owls with high quality refugia habitat from the negative competitive interactions with barred owls. So again, there's a lot more detail in the draft recovery plan, which will be coming out in the next few days. But just your body was specifically called out by the federal government to say, you need to look at your regulations, and we would encourage you to not jump into emergency rulemaking this session or anything like that, but recognize you have a responsibility and that you need to work on this in the coming months. With that, I'm done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean? Given that the Spotted Owl Implementation Team, which you are a member, is in place, appointed by this board, or approved by this board, is that the appropriate place where these considerations of the things you just brought out should occur?
I would suggest that they certainly may provide you some ideas or suggestions, but that implementation team is primarily focused on the incentives piece. And these pieces that the Fish and Wildlife Service are recommending go well beyond the incentives piece. So you would probably need to charge that implementation team with new tasks. They certainly can provide advice, and I know several of the members are here in the room, and one is sitting up there right next to you. So you can encourage us to do other things, but our charge was primarily around the incentives. There's also a science piece. But this is talking specifically about regulations, and I think that the regulatory piece of it is beyond what you've previously charged us with.
And also, Sean, this is a draft plan, right?
Draft for another few days. It's supposed to be finalized in mid-February. So we're expecting any day now for Federal Fish and Wildlife Service to finalize this plan, and then you know, somebody may choose to appeal it, or with any number of things. But it's scheduled to be final within the next days instead of even weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you all.
So Sean has reminded me that I've overlooked an important introduction to make. As I think you're probably aware, Bridget Moran, who's with us this morning, has served as deputy supervisor for a number of years and with a major responsibility of aquatics. She has also recently taken over the responsibility for forest practices, and so she'll be a major component of the staff's involvement with this board. Next up this morning is Pete Heide. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Commissioner and board members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Peter Heide. I'm the senior policy director for the Washington Forest Protection Association. Later this morning, you're going to be hearing a little bit about, but you're going to receive a report on compliance monitoring from staff. And first of all, I want to thank Walt and Rick, staff members, and all the other folks who worked on the field work and prepared the report. I'll repeat what I said to the board a couple of years ago. The objective of our members at WFPA is 100% compliance with the rules. All of our member companies and individuals are committed to operating under the rules and supporting the both the rules and the intent of the Forest Practices Act. We're disappointed that the report that you'll see doesn't really show much, or doesn't show any improvement from the previous report. And rather than dwelling on that, on what the report says, though, I think I'd like to talk about some thoughts I have so the department could use to improve compliance in the future. First of all, feedback is the most important tool, I think, that we have. But delay reduces the value of feedback. Information on where compliance is weak needs to be delivered to the implementing parties as soon as it's available. Don't wait for statistics to prove it for the report to be written. Compliance monitoring team should be communicating what they're seeing in the field as soon as they're comfortable that there's a pattern that they can identify. This alerts forest practice foresters and the folks turning in FBAs that there's some issues out there that ought to get a little closer scrutiny. Thoughtful feedback from compliance monitoring can also help identify opportunities to standardize the measurement methods and for training to reduce the chances of misapplying rules. I call this the short loop adaptive management, and it does work when most of the people are interested in moving in the right direction. Okay, the rules are complex. The measurements needed to implement them are difficult. There are two areas called out in the report that you'll see. First is the stream width measurements and the RMZ length measurements. Implementing these measures may seem simple, but this is a complex natural environment we're dealing with, and errors and inconsistencies are hard to control. Okay, first of all, the fish stream width is important because different size streams have different buffers. Well, it's difficult because streams wander around and they don't cooperate. They stay in a single, straight, consistent bed. The DFC rule was constructed around the area of a simple rectangle, the length of the RMZ times the width of the RMZ. Well, the rectangle model quickly loses its simplicity when the streams travel a crooked path through the woods. Both of these measures have been studied, and we offer our support in developing protocols that might be necessary to reduce the amount of errors in these measurements. And I want to emphasize that. Both of the measurement of these kinds of natural resource factors has been studied. It has been looked at. We know what kind of the error rates are. We know what systems can help us improve. Now, some of these are technical and costly, but we know what to do, I think. And I think we're very happy to get together with the department to work on that. Okay, the last thing is the report does a nice job of pointing out that the majority of non-compliant activities are minor. I know there's some controversy around those reports, but in the end, 90% of the forest practices reviewed were carried out within the rules or in such a way as not to cause significant resource damage. Nevertheless, I just want to close by saying we're still shooting for that high number, that 100% number, and we want to work with the department to improve future compliance. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Pete. Kara Whitaker, please. Good morning, Kara.
Good morning, Commissioner and Board members. My name is Kara Whitaker, and I'm a staff scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center. Later this morning, members of the Conservation Caucus will present to you some serious problems with the implementation of the water typing rules. This issue is of critical importance because the level of protection that streams receive during timber harvest is directly related to their type or classification. For example, fish-bearing streams of type S or F receive buffers that are 90 to 200 feet wide on each side, over 100% of their length. In contrast, non-fish-bearing streams of type NS and NP receive 0 to 50 feet a buffer on each side for 0 to 50% of their length. Stream buffers are essential to the survival of native aquatic species that are covered in the Forest Practices HCP, such as fish, amphibians, and invertebrates, because the buffers provide shade, wood, and nutrients, and they help regulate stream flow and erosion rates. When submitting forest practices applications, landowners are required to correctly identify and type all waters within 200 feet of proposed activity, and to describe how the water types were verified in the field. Unfortunately, this important requirement is not being enforced. Landowner compliance with water typing rules is low, and many miles of fish-bearing streams are being mistyped and underprotected. The Conservation Caucus has identified some straightforward solutions to help alleviate these problems and approve the implementation of the water typing rules. Please direct the DNR to act on these recommendations promptly to ensure the proper protection of our state's valuable aquatic resources. Thank you.
Peter Goldman. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioner and Board. Peter Goldman, Director of the Washington Forest Law Center and representing the Conservation Caucus today. I'd like to thank the Commissioner and the Board. The Caucus would like to thank the Commissioner and the Board for the opportunity to make the water typing compliance presentation later on this morning. What the Board will hear at 11 a.m. is that forest landowner compliance and DNR enforcement of the water typing rules falls well below what most citizens would expect our environmental regulations to be complied with and enforced. 24% of the time, landowners are not typing streams correctly, as Carl pointed out. They're treating fish-bearing streams as non-fish-bearing streams and clear-cutting right down to the banks for half their length. According to the postmortem report, 50% of the time, landowners are either not leaving behind trees on, or are not leaving behind trees on rule-identified landforms. And 40 to 50% of the times, landowners are not getting the DFC calculation, how many trees to be left in the managed buffer, right? The Board's also going to hear that DNR's water typing maps are notoriously inaccurate, something forest stakeholders have known for many years. Landowners are too often relying on the DNR base map, not checking the physical criteria, which is the width and gradient, and DNR is not going out and checking those, and there are there's no reliable system of submitting water type change forms so that at least someone can go confirm the downgrading the stream. And again, as a result, miles of fish-bearing streams are being clear-cut without agency oversight. We know that enforcement and compliance is based on a multitude of factors. Landowner, good faith, agency commitment to enforce, accurate technical materials, adequate resources for the agency to provide oversight. We hope that landowners want to get water typing right, but compliance monitoring unfortunately demonstrates that something is not working. DNR needs to step up, and if necessary, the Board may need to change the rules to require more rigorous confirmation of water typing field calls. The Board cannot do it all, we know that. DNR is this Board's partner in regulating forestry. The Board cannot raise fees for permits to put more people on the ground. But there are certain things, as my colleagues at 11 o'clock will identify, that this Board can simply do within its authority to ensure that the forest practice permit system works the way it's supposed to work. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris Mendoza.
Good morning, Commissioner, Board. My name is Chris Mendoza. I'm the science representative for the Conservation Caucus. This morning I'm going to speak about compliance monitoring report. It seems to be the theme this morning. First of all, like Pete, I'd like to thank Walt for getting the report out. I'd also like to thank the Board and the Commissioner particularly for designating an oversight committee to the compliance monitoring review team, which has been helpful. Having said that, there are still a few items that are in the report that I've commented on in the prior biennium and also are consistent with this biennium report. And the first one is that I don't know if you have this available in front of you, there's a table that breaks down tables 4 and 5 for compliance monitoring stats. Now statement about wanting to achieve a certain level of compliance, 80% compliant, I think was the prior biennium, and this biennium I believe it was 85%. But then when you dig into the details of compliance monitoring broken down by whether they're riparian or road related, you get into this sort of laws of averaging. And so the example I'm going to present here is that you may have an overall compliance, say, on riparian activities of 77%, and that's taken out of the table. When you look into the details of it, a lot of the typed up riparian compliance ratings are at 50%, 60%, 57%. So if you look to the right, you can see that there's compliance quite a bit higher on type NS, that's seasonal non-fish streams, 95%. Wetlands, and they even got salvage in there. So my point is simply that if you combine compliance rates of type F channels with those that are seasonal non-fish, simply by averaging them, some rates are going to be inflated and some not. So using this technique, you could achieve 80% compliance overall repairing activities and still be in the 50% range on salmon and trout streams with repairing compliance. So I think it's important that this report distinguish between compliance rates of type F versus type N, where, as you heard earlier, the prescriptions are quite different, particularly when you have an HCP with listed species that are mainly aquatic, that is fish and amphibian. So one of my constructive criticisms over the years have been to break this out in a more meaningful way so that rather than shooting for an overall average of compliance, which really masks some of the details of important compliance ratings, particularly on type F streams, that they're broken out early so that people can actually see what compliance rates are. And as Pete said earlier, I'd like to acknowledge those landowners that are doing the right thing on the landscape, because there are many of them out there that are complying with the rules as they stand. Some of the compliance, non-compliance rates may be associated with ambiguity in certain rules. I think that is the case as well. But there are also cases where there's just non-compliance where the rule is not being enforced. Second point is, Pete also mentioned this earlier about the professional judgment calls. This is another issue I've had over the years, and that is that the sentence on professional judgment calls states, though it is beyond the scope of this program to quantify resource damage, comma, and then it goes on to do just that. If it's beyond the scope of it, then the report shouldn't designate nearly half its body to the results of something. Minor, moderate, major calls, when it comes to resource damage, takes a lot more than just looking out on the ground at the time you're there. There's two components of resource damage. One is rule effectiveness. Rule effectiveness is conducted by CMER, not the compliance monitoring program. We test whether rules are effective in achieving resource objectives and performance targets. Once you have those answers, you can say something about resource damage. If you're out on the ground in the middle of summer and the road looks great, that might be the case. But when the next storm hits, that may not be the case. So those kind of calls are also limited by seasonality. So the professional judgment calls, I think, need more clear definitions, and I think they need to be weighted with the fact that it's a one Photoshop opportunity to see something that may or may not be there. And lastly, that it does not address cumulative effects. In other words, you may see issues of minor or moderate as defined by the compliance monitoring report at one individual site, but additive over a watershed, these could potentially present a much bigger impact. Thank you for your time.
Miguel Perez Gibson. Good morning, Miguel.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome, Bridget Moran, former Forest Practices Board member. Maybe some of you remember. She was talking like a New Yorker the other day. She sounded like Al Pacino from The Godfather. Just when I thought I was out, they drug me back in. I just want to underscore a few comments that were already made today by the commissioner, because I think they're worth underscoring. One is the Forest Practices Program budget. And to a large extent, I think the larger picture, this is the viability HCP. A lot of commitments were made, not the least of which was the FREP program. Happy to say that Washington Environmental Council was there supporting that bill yesterday. Also, the Small Forest Landowner Office, the Adaptive Management Program, and enforcement. So I just want to underscore that the budget is a priority of the environmental community. We are working on it, and we're very much tracking and concerned about these issues. The other issue I just wanted to point out as a general comment is natural resources organizations that are being considered by the governor and also by various legislators. We've yet to see where that will land, but that is something that could affect the effectiveness of the programs we care about. And then in the issue of fees, the other issue that was discussed earlier, I just want to say that there's a lot of opportunity here. There's also a lot of, to be blunt, I guess, case for mischief. A couple of bills this morning on the HPA bill. One is actually asking that that program be terminated. And, of course, as fees are being discussed, some folks are going to want to say, especially fee payers, that they want to see more efficiency. And then others will say, well, we want to make sure we still have effectiveness on that. So that's going to be an interesting dialogue that will occur. But the topic I want to talk about specifically, though, is the controversy around biomass, because I think there's a work that's on the agenda for later, but I just wanted to talk about it from perspective that the board can play an important role, I think, in the states dealing with this, what is becoming a controversial topic. I don't want to use hyperbole, but it's almost becoming hysteric in some ways. Of course, the main issues are around health, energy efficiency, but I think this board can deal with the issue of sustainability of the feedstock. I think the board could remove one part of the controversy by creating best management guidelines. Obviously, I don't have time to talk about that today, but it's hopefully something that we can continue to have dialogue over the course of the next few months. And I just want to bring up the cautionary tale of the spotted owl. If we've learned anything, I think what we've learned is we don't want to create systems where endangered species species become threatened and endangered. So now, why a lot of this material is not that marketable, I think we can address the issues of what we need to leave on the ground, not really have a chilling effect, if you will. I think that's the concern of some folks, that we're going to sort of scare off people. But if we can address the habitat that's associated with downwoody material and ensure that that part of the forest will remain healthy and intact, I think that'll also take away part of the concerns that are out there on this evolving new industry. I think it will also help with the pulp and paper part of this concerns as well. And just the whole notion of what role electricity plays coming from the forest. And finally, with some well thought out management guidelines, I think we could also help address the fire fuel reduction problems we have on the east side in terms of fire. So I think there's an opportunity here that if left unmet, will be an opportunity missed. And thank you very much. Taking questions.
Thank you, Miguel. So that concludes our public comment period for items of general interest. And we'll move right along into our staff reports, beginning with adaptive management. Jim Holtman. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. My name is Jim Holtman, and I'm your adaptive management program administrator. And the staff report I presented to you or sent in the mail was evolved around one of our reports. There's a number of them that should be coming out over the next year. This report is currently, and it's on the road sub-basin scale effectiveness monitoring. And this report is currently in policy, and policy will have as much as 180 days to decide whether they come to you with this in terms of a recommendation. It could be no action, it could be alternatives with rule language, and that's yet to be determined. So this report, I might say that this was independently reviewed through our scientific review committee and got fairly high remarks in terms of the study design and the thoroughness. So a good report.
Any questions? Do you have any questions, board members? All right, thank you. I will remind board members that all of these reports are, of course, included in your packet. And the staff members are coming forward just to make a brief overview of what's included in the full report. The next then is staff report on the board manual. Donnell, good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner and board members. We are convening the RMAP board manual that will be happening this month. We expect a pretty aggressive timeline for that, meeting twice a month, if not more, to make sure that we can meet our May approval date that we're trying to achieve. We are also currently working on the Riparian Open Space board manual. That is moving along quite smoothly, and we're pretty close to completion on that. And we are also working on the watershed analysis, the component that's associated with mass wasting, and that is moving along smoothly as well. And we fully expect to be bringing these three board manuals to you in May for approval. Any questions?
Danielle, because the RMAP rule is not on the agenda today to move forward yet, is that going to change the timeline that you originally laid out for the board manual for road RMAP?
No. We still are planning on moving forward and hitting that main target. Mark is going to be addressing some other portions of that, but the board manual will be moving forward.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Clean Water Act Assurances, Marquette. Morning, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, all. At the last board meeting, I essentially did kind of a quick update for you on the Clean Water Act assurances, and I promised that at this board meeting I would provide you with a little bit more detailed information. So the report that you should have all received in your packet is essentially a summary of progress on meeting the milestones to retain the Clean Water Act assurances that have been accomplished, or large, or almost accomplished in the past 6 month period. There have been six milestones that have been completed. Several have been almost completed. And where we sit at this point in time is we finished all the 2009 milestones, and we're going to meet the 2011 milestones for the operational compliance monitoring parts of the program. But we're still only about half done with the 2010 milestones. So it's kind of an awkward position in some respects. There's some forward momentum on many of those milestones, but on others there is none at all. Part of this is the drop in staffing that DNR has had to absorb, as well as the rest of the stakeholders. And just other issues have come to the forefront that have occupied our attention, like fixed width buffers and some of the other ones that we hadn't originally planned on. But I think there's a good chance that we can get moving in this next year, because we don't have a lot of other new milestones coming forward to catch up. But again, I think everybody has kept the Clean Water Act assurances in kind of the forefront, but there are so many competing priorities that it's beginning to slow it down. So the biggest problem, probably long term, remains the CEMER research budget and the capacity of volunteer scientists to do the work. Any questions?
All right. Any questions?
Sherry. Mark, under your non-CEMER project milestones, December 2009, evaluated the existing process for resolving field disputes and identified improvements that could be made. It says the milestone was met. Kind of haven't been in the field on a few ID teams. I'm not sure they have been met.
Well, so that would be good to hear that.
What would be your process that you have
There was a process for resolving disputes was established that hopefully we are starting to roll out in the field, because it was agreed upon. And if we're having trouble still, that would be a good thing for us all to know. I'm sure DNR is just as interested as ecology is if, in fact, we are still stuck high-centered on making decisions.
Yes, my question also is every stakeholder that's invited to an ID team meeting, are they all being asked to abide by the same existing process?
That's my understanding. And the dispute resolution process was introduced and discussed at TFW meetings.
maybe we should have an offline discussion.
Oh, okay. That sounds good.
Yes, Carol?
Several places in the report, which I found very useful, and was happy to see that some were getting completed. There was a concern about from WEPSAG about the wetlands research projects and priorities, and that under each of these it was milestone in question. And so how significant is the in question, and is that getting resolved?
Well, the report does use the same terminology to stay consistent between issues, yet the issues really are different. And for the wetland road mitigation study that was on the front burner and we thought would be implemented soon, the final steps to trying to get that program on the ground caused some rethinking on whether, in fact, it was the appropriate direction to go. And so WETSAG, in fact, today, in fact, this afternoon, I'll tie in with a phone call with them to make sure we're on the same page, is looking at trying to essentially rethink where they are and what the best way to move ahead is in general, basically a new strategy for that program. Essentially, the short answer is that the study they originally intended to do wasn't going to provide the kind of information we really needed and may not have really been the priority question to ask. So now they're taking a half step back and saying, what is the best way and most efficient way for us to move forward and get these questions addressed about whether the rules are effective in protecting wetlands or not? And to their credit, they've taken a pretty positive attitude about a lot of stakeholders joining them at the end and then asking them to take a step back and think again. And they're doing, that's exactly what's happening right now. I'm actually pretty optimistic about that.
I'd just like to remind board members that the Clean Water Assurance is one of the big benefits of the Clean Water Assurances is that ecology and or EPA is not doing team deals on forest lands. So we call that direct to implementation. And the context of this is it's important that we continue to move forward on this and we meet as many of these milestones as possible. Mark will be bringing even a more complete report in May or August to us. As you might remember, last year in May, he took a look at things, made some reasonable adjustments based on workload and so forth. Where it was appropriate. We will do that again this year in the context of what comes out of the legislature regarding policy bills and budget and so forth, and report back to the board on where we think clean water assurances are at that time. But it's also in the context that without this piece being successful, we also are, this piece is part of ecology's work plan to complete the consent decree we have on a lawsuit with plaintiffs on achieving TMDLs on a certain time frame. So, and I will speak to that more at the next meeting and explain that. But that's an important piece, the context that the board members need to remember.
So I want to remind everyone, board members included, you need to speak up a little bit. We may hear here at the board your remarks, but we want to make sure the audience does as well. Paula, you had some questions?
I did. Two questions. So Stephen partially addressed this, but my broader question is, what are the implications of sort of the accumulation of some of these milestones not being met for being able to retain Clean Water Act assurances? And then my second question is there a strategy to make sure that CEMA has the funding that it needs to carry out the studies to make sure milestones are being met? And if not, is there something that we, the board, need to be doing to put a strategy together?
Well, ecology is concerned about what is beginning to become a backlog of work. Some of the more difficult interim milestones are the ones where no motion has happened. And so that is a concern to us. But that is part of the reason why I mentioned that for 2011, and some of those lay within the operational context of the milestones, they're really, we're on target for the 2011 operational milestones. So there won't be a compounding of the 2010 on top of 2011 for those people who tend to be at the forefront of trying to accomplish those milestones. So we have an opportunity to kind of get on track here. But I've said that a couple times before, and we haven't got on track. So I'm saying that with a little kind of nervousness in my voice, if you will. The steamer part of the picture is the more difficult one, in part because those issues are much larger. It's a much bigger challenge when you need to come up with study designs and go through peer review and get consensus on every step of the way for a multi-million dollar study that can last, you know, from 3 to 13 years. So that part of the program is probably the biggest worry. I think we'll be okay with the operational part of it. We set up the milestones, though, to set a base of improvement that we hope we could just keep building on. So it's not good to see those things be delayed, even if we can eventually catch up, because that wasn't the original intention there. As far as budgeting goes, the strategy that was laid out was to let the principals try to go after that money, try to solve that dilemma. To date, it's been kind of a year-by-year fix. And so we still don't have that comprehensive long-term solution in place.
Any other questions? Yes, Norm.
In the report, in the non-SEMR project milestones section of it, there are a number of these where it said ecology provided suggested approach, no further action on this issue has occurred. I think that's repeated in 3 or 4 different places. So my question is, what needs to happen at this point? Is it just stuck in ecology because of staffing issues? Is it bottlenecked because of some other process or issue that we need to be aware of?
It's just a workload issue with DNR management being able to tackle those issues, really. They're just overwhelmed with work right now. So ecology tried to...
Is it DNR or ecology?
DNR.
Okay.
We didn't want to be in the position of not being helpful. So what we tried to do is come up with a potential solution, one way that the milestone could be met for each one of those issues, and provided that to DNR. And the intention is for us to work on those, but with all the other issues and the loss in staff, which then concentrates the workload on who's remaining, they have not been able to address it. So they're sitting there on, you know, the ground at the moment. Hopefully the fact that some ground has been broken on it will help us get them resolved quickly once they can take a look at it.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Next report, rulemaking activity. Mark?
Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board. I'm Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager in Enforced Practices. The rulemaking schedule fairly short in this presentation in that today before the board is the forest biomass, riparian open space and watershed analysis rulemakings. We're going to request the board initiate the next step by filing the CR 102 to initiate rulemaking. We will bring forward a status report for RMAP and the notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes is still being reviewed. We could expect language at the May meeting. Also, I'd like to add on the board map to implement requested changes for RMAPs. That committee is actually scheduled to meet for the first time this week, so we are initiating that board meeting. Excuse me. Are there any questions?
All right. Thank you, Mark, for that report. More to follow. Next one is Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee and Small Forest Landowner Office. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Commissioner and members of the board. I'm Mary McDonald with the Small Forest Landowner Office. I'm just going to bring a couple of things to your attention very quickly. I see that several members of the Landowner Caucus for the Advisory Committee will be speaking later today, so I'm going to jump right into a couple other things. From my report, I'd like to everybody notice, to the audience, that this is the implementation report for the Family Forest Fish Passage Program. It should have been included in your packet for 2010. And then also I want to talk about, just briefly show you an example of a newsletter that we have in conjunction with WSU, and I have it up here online. There it is. And so this is a newsletter that is available only on the web, and that we are trying to keep things cost effective. A postcard is being sent out to 90,000 landowners and asking them to sign up. Within the last 2 weeks, we have seen a 10% increase in this newsletter and people signing up for it. And I just want to show you a real quick hot link and then I'm out of here. Oh, yeah. As you scroll down, this is several pages, but what a landowner can do is just here. This is in a book for conifer diseases that's available through British Columbia. And if they click on it, it goes immediately to the website. This is pretty cool, I think. So I just wanted to share that with you.
So Mary, what percentage of the small forest landowners in the state, and the number is north of 200,000, I understand, have internet access?
We just had, with this newsletter, we are able to check to see how they are connecting to this, and it was under 1% that is on dial-up. The majority is on Wi-Fi or through cable or something, and it was all like 25%. So it was less than 1% that are on dial-up.
But what percentage are have access by whatever means?
I don't know that.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Sherry.
I just have a comment. I just got signed up here just last week. Pretty impressed with what you and the stewardship program are doing for small landowners. It's most excellent to get that information out. This is the only way we have to do it now.
You know, because we can't
afford the paper, the mail.
Savings.
Yeah, it's just so efficient. And obviously, this is one of my favorite programs. congratulations on all the work you've done.
Thanks,
folks. Appreciate it.
Other questions?
I'd just like to remind board members that, you know, in addition to this, you know, the policy folks have initiated a federal request for money to match what is going on with this program. Whether we're successful is a different issue, but we have another brochure that most all FFR folks plus some have signed up to support a federal request to match the triple S program.
Stephen, you should have brought that jobs in the wood pamphlet for the board to see.
Sure, we can get copies
of
that during lunch.
Cool.
Yes, Carol.
Well, I was just thinking about access and making sure everybody can get to these resources, which are important. And just to, as you're talking, not to forget to mention the public libraries, because they all have internet connections that are free still. And, you know, a great way for people to get access if they don't have things at home.
All right. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Next is a staff report on Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly. Sherry, good morning.
Good morning, Chair. Sherry Felix, Policy Analyst for the Fish Practices Division, and this morning, Mr. David Whipple is sitting on me. In your board packet, you will find the DNR, the Fish and Wildlife, third annual report on the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly. This is a state endangered species. The board has approved a voluntary cooperative approach to protect this butterfly from potential adverse effects of forest practices. This approach relies on tracking the forest practices by Fish and Wildlife and DNR
that are within 1 mile of habitat designated by Fish and Wildlife, conditioning these permits when Fish and Wildlife deems that forest practice poses a risk to that species, voluntary landowner planning with Fish and Wildlife, and annual reports to the board. I'm happy to report that none of the 2010 permits within 1 mile of Taylor Checker Spot habitat were deemed by Fish and Wildlife to pose a risk to the species. And on that note, we believe it's important to more clearly state this fact in the report and to also better specify the location of one of those 2010 permits in the report. So we will do so and get you that updated report hopefully.
Also just wanted to make sure that the board remembers that back in February 2010, we have two management plans that have been completed to date out of the five large forest landowners. Merrill and Ring Company finished theirs and signed it on February 10th of 2010. And then I believe it was just prior to the last board meeting in November that DNR completed theirs with us and we signed that agreement. So two are done. The last I had heard, one was going through an internal review within the company, and we need to follow up with those folks. And then there was another landowner, a large landowner, that probably, well, I know that they don't have any activities planned around their site for a very long time, in their words. And so I'm kind of envisioning a plan that would be extremely simple and basically say that we're not going to do anything for X number of years and we'll come back and revisit. So, and as you remember, there's also one landowner that is trying to dispose of their property. And so there isn't any activity going on with that landowner either. So, things are kind of moving along a little bit slower than anticipated in terms of management plans, but we do have two done, and we forge good working relationships with those folks. So.
Thank you. Next report is from the TFW Cultural Resources Committee. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Thomas. I am the co-chair of the Tipper Fish and Wildlife Cultural Resources Committee, and for now I'll be reporting alone as Pete's been called off for legislative duty, but maybe he'll be back on in time to wrap it up. But I know I've just got a couple of minutes, so let me go ahead and report to you that the committee has been meeting on a regular basis since our last quarterly report. So we do have our monthly meeting notes that are available, however, not yet posted online because that's not yet been worked out for the committee, as I understand it. But we do look forward to that happening in the very near future. Anybody that would like copies of that, of the meeting notes, can get them through Sherry Felix. But otherwise, what you had submitted to you as of January 11th is a copy of the committee's action item list. You'll see that it's dated January 11th, 2011. However, January 18th letter to the board does describe this as the August 2010 quarterly report, so please consider this a correction. It is actually the January quarterly report for our group. In there, you'll see that we highlight at least three items that are flagged as a high priority. So we provide you a copy of the action item list. It does rate a priority. It does provide a description of items and how the priority level that they has been established for them at the committee. So for the high priority items, which are the three main ones you've been hearing about and that we continue to work on, and we're really close to bringing them to completion, and we really and hope to have at least some of them before you at your next quarterly meeting. You'll note that item one is the official standing of the TFW Cultural Resources Committee, and the work has been focusing upon preparation and finalization of a recommended charter for the group, and so that there are drafts that are available for review that are being circulated at committee level, and we've been so close to finalizing almost every meeting, but then again something comes up, so we're really close though. And then the second high priority item has to do with the Forest Practices Board manual and the development of guidance documents. Our work at this time has been focused upon development of guidance for the landowner and tribal meeting that's referred to under WAC 2222-20120, of which some mention you've already heard during Mark Engel's report. Let me just put out an idea there. If we are going to be preparing a new section of the Forest Practices Board manual, it might be time to start laying the ground for the introduction of that section, giving it a number, maybe putting something in there on the manual saying that the work is still in development, that kind of thing, as has been done for other topics. So this is a little something procedural that I haven't heard discussed yet. Item three of our high priorities would be the 2222-20120 resolutions that I just did mention and that Mark referred to as well. Those are real close. We thought we'd actually have something before you here at the February meeting, but it looks like it's probably going to come up at your next quarterly meeting. So we hope to really put the final touches to that and have something out to you in fairly short order. You'll also see that on the back page of our action item list is an ongoing tasks list. And for those right now, I would highlight that we are doing our regular reports, both quarterly and annual, and we are still pursuing development of the website. So again, I've mentioned that, and I know the committees are eagerly looking forward to that becoming a reality so that we can really get the message out and share our good work with all the TFW stakeholders. Maybe one last thing that has come to the committee's attention that you might be hearing about is the need for a very slight correction under WAC, under the Class 4 Special WAC, where we need to update a description that has been otherwise put into place in another portion of the WACs, and so we want to get them to match up. Sherry will probably be able to provide more background on that. Maybe the last thing I'd like to say is that for the Forest Practices Board manual, we are trying to focus on particular areas as we develop the section. We have assignments out to Peter Heide to work on the process and procedural ideas that we have that the committee has decided to focus upon for development. Also, a tribal contact list, the website development. Others are working on the identification of common site types and the ways that they're protected, and then finally this landowner tribal meeting guidance that I referenced. This is really what the committee will be meeting on at our upcoming meeting next week. So we continue to progress. We continue to, we continue to progress and be very appreciative of the ongoing support that we get from the TFW stakeholders and the Forest Practices Board in particular. So anytime that you need to know more about our committee, please feel free to contact I or Peter Heide, and we always welcome you at our meetings and would really look forward to some kind of regular attendance. Thank you very much. Any questions, please?
Thank you for the report. So the last staff report is on upland wildlife. Dave?
Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board. My name is David Whipple. I'm the Forest Policy Coordinator for Permanent Fish and Wildlife. I'll try to be real brief. I see that the time is getting by us a little bit, but there are some, I think most of you probably have heard this update before. I don't recall if board member Little has or not, but it's unfortunate that some other folks on the board are not here tonight to try to give them an update. But nonetheless, I just want to give a really quick little background and then kind of ask you to look at the memo that I've submitted. Way back when, in probably 2001, 2002, when the board's work on forest and fish was kind of ramping down to some extent, there was still working on the forest and fish rule adoption, but the emergency rules were in place. We were doing the FRAP program rules and such. But there was a recognition and a lot of a discussion at the board level that there was a need to kind of get back to wildlife because so much time and effort had been spent on forest and fish, and that there are rules that speak to evaluating the upland wildlife rules. So the board asked DFW to develop and lead the work plan with stakeholders. And as you know, there's four elements to the wildlife work plan: assessment of current rules, landscape level wildlife assessment, implementation mechanisms and incentives for wildlife habitat management, and also adaptive management. So I won't go through those all over again, except for kind of following up with maybe some next steps. And there was a bit of public testimony today on Miller Spot Owl implementation team, we are still doing owls. And that was the first species, the first rule to be assessed under the board's work plan. And I think we were optimistic originally about how long that was going to take, but nonetheless, we're still doing that. And we have a lot of moving pieces now with the recovery plan and so forth. So it's going to take some effort to hopefully make some progress on that, whatever direction that may go, and see some conclusions so we can get on to some other things. We are, as far as the landscape level wildlife assessment, we're still pursuing outside funding. As you remember, funding was not provided by the legislature, and so that project was essentially mothballed quite a while ago now. We've had some promising discussions with the Forest Service, because they're conducting some similar types of assessments and using similar types of tools. And there's a possibility that we may be able to partner with those folks and be mutually beneficial. So some of the other work that we're going to be taking up in conjunction with keep going with the owls, the owl work, are some work on bald eagles and peregrine falcons and gray wolf. And those are the rules that kind of pertain, they're kind of at the lower end of the priority list for the species rules to be evaluated. And it was thought while we're doing owl work and some other stuff that we might be able to still have capacity to do that. Capacity is still an issue, but we're going to be moving forward with, and as you'll see in the memo, with hopefully some modification to the bald eagle and peregrine falcon rules as a package, because that makes sense. Those species are both delisted. We're kind of waiting for the dust to settle on the gray wolf issue from the federal perspective and the ESA listing. And so the gray wolf will be coming kind of after that dust settles and after our Fish and Wildlife Commission adopts a wolf management plan for the state. So I think with that, I'd like to take any questions if you have any.
Questions for Dave?
So way back when, ancient history, I remember your department thinking that murrelets were also a high priority several years ago. Has that assessment changed? I understand that there are resource constraints in actually accomplishing it, but does Department of Fish and Wildlife still consider doing existing rule assessment on murrelets an important thing to do?
Yes, that species is the number two species, the number rule on the list to be assessed after owls. And we do still think it's important. It's one of those species that, it's listed, its populations are in very good shape. And I think we should assess it with our eyes wide open, but staffing is a really significant issue. And it's not just for us, it's for the other stakeholders as well. So I'm not sure how we tackle that and when we tackle that. I think it'll, to some extent, depend upon what happens with the owl under the work plan. And then if we can make some progress on the other three species, the eagle, falcon, and the wolf, and take care of those, then if the owl work allows us, maybe we can start picking up some other species rules on the work plan. So I think it's kind of a wait and see for a little while yet. But that's just my perspective, but it's the board's work plan, so.
All right, thank you very much, Jay. So that completes our staff reports for this morning. Moving on, and I apologize, but I'm going to have to keep us moving rapidly here. Next item is a review of the 2011 work plan. Mark?
Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board, and Mark Engel. This last fall, the governor issued Executive Order 10-06, and with that came accompanying language for exemptions issued by OFM. In your packet, we sent you a copy of the executive order as well as the accompanying memo and an analysis of the current rulemakings that the board has initiated. What staff has found is that the guidelines for exemptions are found in three of the exemptions, and that every rulemaking meets one or more of the exemptions. With running late, I will quickly go through and then open it up for discussion by the board. What we have done is we've attached the 2011 work schedule that the board approved at the November meeting for the board to see those rulemakings that we've initiated and then discuss the possibility, if the board chooses, to delay the initiation of rulemaking for any of the rules. The executive order asks that, when possible, to delay rulemakings until after December 31st of this calendar. So with that being said, the Right Parent Open Space Program does meet criteria 3E, and that it is beneficial to regulated entities, local government, and small businesses by broadening the scope of eligible recipients to receive conservation easements for state-listed critical habitats and all channel migration zones. Steven. Scally. Forest biomass. We believe this rulemaking is necessary to protect public health by ensuring clean water and natural resources by making forest biomass a regulated forest practices activity. Watershed analysis. This meets two criteria. It's necessary to protect natural resources and public health and safety. And it was requested and supported by the board, state agencies, and regulated industries. RMAPs, though we're delaying, is still on the schedule. And it actually meets three of the criteria, in that it protects natural resources, public health, public safety, and that it's beneficial and supported by regulated entities, and particularly necessary to manage budget shortfalls. The last one is not before the board today, but it is, again, as we mentioned earlier, the potential rulemaking for notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes. That actually meets two of the criteria. It's supported by regulated entities. In fact, it would create a more streamlined, more certain process for a landowner when they apply for a forest practices activity for that application to be approved. And it also is protects natural resources, public health, and safety. So are there any questions? Or
David? I'm sure you intended to say not all CMZs, but all unconfined CMZs.
All confined CMZs, but both avulsing and meandering. It does expand the number of CMZs that would be eligible for a riparian open space conservation.
Other questions for Mark? So we're trying to be very careful here and answer the governor's directive. But clearly, this rulemaking package, we think, falls. I mean, to begin with, this is an independent state agency, and we do so voluntarily to and respectfully comply with the governor's request. But we think these rulemaking activities are clearly exempt from what she is proposing. So that's essentially what Mark has walked us through, and I think you all understand that we're trying to be good members of a state government that's under a lot of pressure, and we want to consider that request. But where important, we will cite those exemptions and follow them. So thank you very much for that report. I think at this time we're running just a little bit late on the agenda. I'm going to take a 7-minute break here, and we will reconvene at 10:25. And just be forewarned, I'm going to do that promptly, because we've got to keep moving. Thank you. We're adjourned.